And the court will proceed to the fourth case of the day, Belleville Catering versus Champaign Market. Mr. Evans.
Good morning, court. Counsel, Mr. Light. The primary issue before this court is whether or not the plaintiff's fraud claims that the district court should have been barred by the ruling of the district court on the motion for judgment on the pleadings filed by the defendant. The closet issue, this was a commercial lease. Article 33 of the lease, which is part of the appendix, was a standard.
Before we get to the merits, I wonder whether the district court had subject matter jurisdiction in this case. The document filed in this court, the briefs and the Rule 28 statements of jurisdiction, say that the defendant is a limited liability corporation. Actually, your language is it's a Delaware limited liability corporation with its principal place of business in Illinois. That treats an LLC as if it were a corporation, but we've held that an LLC is equated to a partnership for purposes of diversity jurisdiction. So we need to know the citizenship and principal place of business of every investor in the LLC. Does the record show that information?
No, Your Honor, it does not.
Then it doesn't establish diversity. There's one other problem. The complaint alleges, and your brief recites, that the plaintiff is a Missouri corporation. According to the Illinois Secretary of State, however, the plaintiff is incorporated in Illinois. And according to the Missouri Secretary of State, the plaintiff is an Illinois corporation licensed to do business in Missouri. That suggests that there has never been diversity at all. That there is some very serious problem in the jurisdictional basis of this suit.
As those issues were never dealt with in the district court, Your Honor, I don't have any response at this time to those. Assuming, and I do assume that those are correct, then the district court would have been without subject matter jurisdiction, would continue to be without subject matter jurisdiction, just as this court would then be without subject matter jurisdiction.
No, we have jurisdiction because there was a timely appeal from a final decision of the district court. But if the district court lacks subject matter jurisdiction, the only thing for us to do is vacate and remand with instructions to dismiss. If indeed there wouldn't be an occasion for sanctions in this case for imposing on the district court in a case where there was obviously no subject matter jurisdiction.
All that I can say to that, Your Honor, is based on my knowledge of the case and the incorporation steps at the time, prior to the time that the lawsuits were filed in the district court, that it was my understanding that my clients were, or that there was diversity jurisdiction based on the status of my clients as individuals and as the corporation. And if the court's position is that the failure of the subject matter jurisdiction at this stage requires this court to remand and then instruct the district court to dismiss the case and vacate the judgment for lack of subject matter jurisdiction,
well,
so be it.
28 U.S.C. 1653 says that the pleadings may be amended even in the Court of Appeals to show jurisdiction, if indeed there is any. So you might, if it is consistent with honest pleading, be able to take advantage of that, but that would require some accurate determination of the plaintiff's place of incorporation and of the citizenship of every member of the LLC.
And obviously I cannot have that information available to advise the court on that.
Would you like time to file something?
I think that having this been raised, I would ask leave to investigate this and file the appropriate pleadings to try to ascertain this, certainly because this matter was never raised below. And
well, I'll the court will allow both sides 10 days from this date to file anything they believe appropriate speaking to the issue of jurisdiction.
Thank you.
if you want to address the merits, this is your only opportunity.
Yeah. Well, I, with due respect to your research, I'm very concerned as to whether we get to the merits. But to briefly jump back on track, with regard to the representation clause at issue in this particular lease, we would note to the court that representation clause is not the type of reliance clause that the courts traditionally have said that the parties can contract away their right to bring a fraud claim. The representation in this clause simply states, speaks of inducements and representations. The other thing that I think is most important in this particular case was at the stage that the district court made its decision in this case was at the pleading stage where the district court's required to accept all facts as true as we have alleged. The First Amendment complaint, which was at issue and which was decided upon in the motion of judgment of pleading, states plausible claims for fraudulent inducement in this case. The district court contested some of those allegations based on the Article 33 of the lease and the affidavit signed by Mr. Garanzini, representative of the corporation. With regard to the guarantee at issue, those same clauses were not in the guarantee, and the guarantor's claim should have been able to proceed both with their primary claim based on fraudulent inducement as well as their claim or their affirmative defense based on fraudulent inducement. And our final point we'd like to note to the court was that the damages for the common area maintenance and real estate tax assessments in this case were not sufficiently proven by the mall. The accountant testified that she, in her own words, was guesstimating certain of these amounts. Furthermore, she testified that the remaining tenants at the mall, in this case, picked up those payments as part of their lease. So there was not a situation where the mall was out of pocket and therefore
what
not sustained damages.
What difference would that make? I assume that Illinois follows the collateral benefit or collateral source rule. So if the mall had insurance, the fact that it's reimbursed makes no difference.
It
doesn't make any difference that it has some other collection device.
But the premise, and I agree with you, Your Honors, but the premise in this case is a breach of contract claim where there was no actual loss sustained because the funds were
recovered. But I don't understand that. That would just be like saying that if an insurer reimbursed, no actual loss would be sustained. If you have a condominium association that has real estate taxes on the condominium and there are six owners, if owner number six doesn't pay, the other five are going to have to chip in to pay the taxes or the city will foreclose, right? On your view, that implies that you couldn't sue, the condominium association couldn't sue owner number six for failure to pay his share of the taxes.
I think that in the nature of contract damages, though, there has to be an actual loss sustained. And based on...
Yes, the association sustains the loss, which is then reimbursed by five of the six members. And so here, the defendant sustained the loss, which was reimbursed by the other tenants.
But all of these reimbursements are contractual with all of the tenants in a shopping center.
Exactly. That's why I gave you the condominium case.
And
if you think the condominium association can recover from the defaulting tenant who failed to pay his taxes, then you have to think that the shopping center developer can recover from the defaulting tenant who failed to pay his taxes.
But in the shopping center leases, the thing that distinguishes that, Judge, is the fact that the shopping center leases are based upon the occupied space of the mall, and all of these calculations for the common area and real estate tax assessments are driven by the tenants who are occupying the premises. The other note, though, which is aside to previous argument is the fact that the accountant who presented this testimony testified she didn't have concrete numbers and was guesstimating at the amounts that she felt were due. I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Evans. Mr. Light.
May it please the court and counsel, the trial court was correct in granting the motion for judgment on the pleadings. We have a lease which has clear and explicit language that no oral representations were made, that there was no reliance on any oral representations, and the lease contains language waiving liability.
What have you to say about the jurisdiction in this case?
I have nothing to add other than I believe guarantors are from Missouri. The guarantors are from Missouri, but Your Honor, I also
that
going to
ask you. The My initial question had to do with who are the members of the LLC and what is their citizenship. I thought you might know. After all, your clients.
Your Honor, I believe that there are members in a number of different states, including Illinois. But I don't have enough to present to you for you to decide on that particular issue.
But, you know, I just don't understand why issues like this reach oral argument in the Court of Appeals. The rule in this circuit is crystal clear. Our jurisdictional statement rule, Rule 28, says that if a party is anything other than a corporation, one must state the citizenship of the members. And the LLC is something other than a corporation. All one had to do was follow the circuit rules.
All I can say on my behalf, Your Honor, is that we were sued in that court, and we did not contest, and we filed a counterclaim in that lawsuit, which was brought against us in that court, and we ended up obtaining a judgment on that counterclaim. So we did not bring it there.
You did not lose your judgment.
Well,
you might want to be sure you were in the right court system before litigating it.
Well, I appreciate the 10 days that the court has granted us.
Let me just add that I realize, Counselor Sardi, you may have till two more days till Monday, November 3rd, to do it. I just want to underscore something Judge Easterbrook has said. Obviously, all federal courts have to be sensitive and should be to their jurisdiction, but there may be no circuit court that has spoken more loudly to the issue of being aware on jurisdiction than the Seventh Circuit. So it is imperative that counsel recognize that as almost a primary and first obligation.
Well, I appreciate that, Your Honor. With regard to the merits, and I thank you, I believe that the clear and explicit language in the lease clearly bars Belleville Catering's case. I believe that the Regensburger case, the Vigortone case, say this, that this language bars Belleville Catering's claim. We have an involved commercial lease here. We don't have student housing at the University of Illinois and a lease signed by an 18-year-old student. So I think that language clearly bars the claim. And as to the guarantors, we have a guarantee, which again has clear and explicit and involved language, that the guarantors stepped into Belleville Catering's shoes. And as a matter of fact, by the guarantee language, their liability is more extensive. There is nothing in the complaint where the guarantors alleged that they were fraudulently induced to enter into the guarantee. So I believe that the guarantors are also bound by the language in the lease and the guarantee. With regard to the issue of damages, Belleville Catering wants this court to set aside a jury verdict. And the jury verdict is supported by evidence apart from the issue of the common area maintenance and the taxes. Indeed, the verdict is just a little bit less than the full amount claimed minus the common area maintenance and taxes. Reading between the lines, it seems like that is indeed what the jury did, was discount the verdict amount by the amount of the common area maintenance and taxes, and Belleville Catering is merely speculating that the jury did award common area maintenance and taxes as part of their verdict, and such speculation would not be a basis for setting aside the jury verdict. In addition, the trial court was correct in letting those damages go to the jury. The lease clearly provides that Belleville Catering and then the guarantors are responsible for those assessments. And what Belleville Catering is asking for, they're asking that they be granted a windfall. They're asking that they be allowed to pass their obligation onto unwilling third parties. And certainly, if we're talking about a mitigation of damages, where Champaign Marketplace would enter into a lease with a willing lessee for that same space, Belleville Catering would be entitled to an offset for that mitigation of damages. That's the willing party. They're looking to pass their obligations on to unwilling parties, to the other tenants. And it seems to me that if, and all the evidence is that it is passed on if the common area maintenance and taxes are not paid by Belleville Catering. That's all the evidence is. Now, if that common area maintenance and taxes would ultimately be paid by Belleville Catering, it seems that perhaps the other tenants would need to get reimbursed. But in any event, there would be an issue between Champaign Marketplace and those other tenants. It doesn't seem to me that it would be the correct thing, the right thing, for Belleville Catering to have a windfall and to be able to pass their obligations on to third parties. And I will finish unless your honors have any questions.
I think not.
Thank you.
Thanks, Blake. Mr. Evans, do you have anything you would respond to?
With regard to the damages, and again, I want to emphasize to the court, this is a breach of contract, and under Illinois law, the mall is only entitled to be put in the same position as it would have been had Belleville Catering presumably honored the terms of the lease in this case. Now, the windfall that results in this case results back to the mall because they have recovered these monies from the tenants who remain, and the judgment actually doubles that recovery back to them. With regard to the issue on the fraud case, Mr. Light noted to the court the Regensburger case. That case was decided at the summary judgment stage. Furthermore, on the fraud claims in that case, the court determined that the plaintiffs did not properly allege a claim for fraudulent inducement, and that was the basis for the summary judgment in that case. Thank you.
All right. The case is taken under advisement. And